Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, December 11th. With us now, journalist and presidential historian Jonathan Alter, who has written books about FDR, Barack Obama, and now one about Jimmy Carter. There's a story in there about how Carter clashed with Joe Biden on the issue of busing for integrating public schools. Jonathan also tweeted today that Hunter Biden could be the Billy Carter of the Biden administration, he'll explain. Jonathan also made the recent documentary about New York journalists Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin that won an Emmy this year for Outstanding Historical Documentary. And Jonathan himself has been a national politics reporter for Newsweek and The Daily Beast as well, so he has his eye on both the past and the present. For example, he is He is not just for the Supreme Court to reject the lawsuit by 18 Republican state attorneys general to undo the presidential election results. He is calling on them to be disbarred on the grounds of sedition against the people of the United States and something called Rule 11. We'll skip Rules 1 through 10 and explain that. With us now is Jonathan Alter. The new book is called His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. Hi, Jonathan. Always great to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Great to be here.
Can we start on the news? What's this Rule 11?
I'm not a lawyer and I don't want to play one on the radio, but that's a rule that allows judges to basically sanction lawyers who file frivolous nuisance suits. We need a new category, what I think of as a menace suit, a suit that is a menace to our Constitution and our democracy. Larry Tribe, who is, you know, one of the great constitutional law authorities, knows much, much more about this than I do. And he has an organization called Lawyers Defending Democracy, which I would urge any attorney who is listening to this program to join, because he is committed to pushing back against what are now being called the seditious 17, those 17 attorneys general or attorney generals who are trying to stage I don't want to put too fine a point on it, gunless coup d'etat in the United States. You know, I'm not that excitable, Brian. You've had me on your program a lot, and I don't usually have my hair on fire. But this is a grave matter. If there's not pushback, if these folks who are trying to overturn the will of the people are not sanctioned, punished at the polls when they run for attorney general the next time or other office, but actually disbarred, or at least concerned that they might be disbarred, then we will lose our democracy in the next election, because they will just litigate the hell out of it like they are this time and refuse to accept the results of the election. So pushback is extremely important. In the short term, we're okay, Brian. Joe Biden will take the oath on January 20th. But in the medium and longer term, we must have lawyers pushing back and sanctioning and disbarring these folks who are trying to upend our democracy.
You sound confident that Joe Biden will take the oath on January 20th, and all the legal analysts seem to say the suit at the Supreme Court now is groundless and doesn't stand a chance. But I was surprised to hear even Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn, usually a Trump ally, say on CNN yesterday that he thinks it's baseless and he wouldn't want other states telling Texas that they can't set their own election rules. So he doesn't want Texas telling these four states who are the defendants. But Romney, Cornyn, Ben Sasse, Republican senator, have come out against this. Otherwise, crickets. And here's a new piece since yesterday's show, listeners. More than 100 Republican members of the House have gone in on the suit. So this isn't just the likes of Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, 18 attorneys general, more than 100 members of Congress now. Does the politics of that give it more of a chance at the Supreme Court, in your opinion, Jonathan?
It makes it a graver threat to our republic, but I don't think it necessarily gives it more of a chance at the Supreme Court. The point that Senator Cornyn was making is a very important one. And by the way, the Republican Attorney General of Ohio has this view. A number of other Republican attorneys general have this view. The Supreme Court is unlikely to take this case because it would then encourage states to sue each other on a lot of other things. And the court in the past has not liked those kinds of cases. And some lawyers I've consulted on this say that they really don't want to incentivize states to sue each other. And also the lawsuit is just completely groundless. I actually, read it. It's a preposterous case on many different levels, as any self-respecting lawyer will tell you. But the real threat, I think, is not this case. Yes, maybe there's a 2%, 5% chance they could hear the case and really put fuel on the fire. But even then, there's no guarantee that they would, I think it'd be unlikely that they would overturn the election, which is what the Texas Attorney General, who, by the way, this guy Paxton, he's looking for a pardon because he is under criminal investigation and is about to get indicted. So he's, there's a corrupt pardon bid that is part of this Texas lawsuit as well. But the larger point, Brian, is however it plays out politically right now, and it's unlikely to change the results of the election, highly unlikely.
Just one more thing on that, though. These 106 members of Congress now, members of the House of Representatives. Yeah. I know you're a presidential historian, not a constitutional lawyer, but Trump has his eyes not just on the Electoral College or on the Supreme Court, but on the day of January 6th, when Congress is supposed to officially accept the Electoral College's vote. Could party politics sabotage the election at that juncture?
No. There are 435 members of the House of Representatives, so 106 doesn't get it done for those who want to usurp our democracy. And that's what they are. They're usurpers. They're giving aid and comfort to a gunless coup d'etat attempt, and they don't have the votes. So, no, I'm not worried about that. What I am worried about, and this is why I do want to just shift the conversation at least briefly, to the medium and long term. I'm worried about amnesia in America, and that Democrats tend to respond to these things by wringing their hands, and then when the danger passes, they move on to something else. And that cannot happen in this time. Otherwise, we will have a huge problem in 2022, because the election results will not be accepted by the Republican Party if there is not sanction and pushback this time. In other words, these guys have to fear that they will either pay at the polls or pay with their law license. And if they don't have any pushback, they will just file these suits the next time. And if the election is closer, they might win and be able to actually set a precedent for overturning the will of the people. So this requires attention. I hope that you do a show on this next year and the year after that and the year after that to find out what has happened to the seditious 17, whether those attorneys general are feeling the heat or not. Right now, they're just afraid of a primary challenge. That's why they did this. They all know it's wrong. I mean, they're lawyers. They know it's pathetic. But they're afraid of a Trumpist primary challenge. The rest of us have to make them afraid that they will lose a general election, and that requires political organizing, or that they will lose their law license or somehow be sanctioned.
Do both parties then need to pull back a little bit? Because Trump supporters see the world in part as Trump being constantly harassed in his time in office by Democrats who never accepted that election. You know, some Democrats in Congress boycotted the inauguration, saying Russian interference made Trump an illegitimate president. Then there was the Mueller investigation for 2 years, which did not find the alleged original sin of collusion with Russia. Then there was impeachment over Ukraine, still trying to get him out of office on what supporters saw as sleazy, but you don't overturn an election for that. They saw that as a soft coup. How much does that explain this full court press against this election's legitimacy as payback? And if you're going to bring up the longer term, do both parties need to pull back from that to any degree? Or do you see this as just a Republican issue?
Well, I think that lowering the temperature is part of what Joe Biden will provide. And that's important. And we also have to build bridges to people who don't agree. And I think there should be maybe a commission on election integrity with Democrats and Republicans. And people have to start talking to each other again. But I don't think this is an even Steven situation. And the Republican Party has gone off the rails, as I think the never Trump Republicans of the Lincoln Project have pointed out consistently and explained extraordinarily well. So, I don't think that Republicans should just get a free pass to de-escalate. But I do agree with, you know, Biden's determination to turn down the temperature. And I think his Justice Department should be very careful about Trumpsters that it decides to prosecute and maybe use some discretion in not going full bore. But, you know, his real legal jeopardy, I think, at this point is Cy Vance here in New York, you know. And there's nothing that the federal government or Joe Biden or Donald Trump with his pardoning power or self-pardoning power, if it comes to that, can do about Cy Vance. And, you know, it's looking like he really may have something to work with. We don't know many details, but there are some indications that there's a real case here with Trump overinflating his assets when he wants to make a deal and grossly understating them for insurance purposes. So, you know, we'll see what happens in New York, as Trump likes to say.
Manhattan DA Cy Vance, that is. Jonathan Alter, our guest, 646-435-7280. And speaking of one-term presidents, your new book is called His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. Why now?
I actually started working on it more than 5 years ago, but you know, I was at the Carter Library when Trump came down the escalator. So in a lot of ways, Jimmy Carter is the un-Trump. You know, he is a man and was a president of great intelligence and honesty. Trump has told over 35,000 lies. I actually couldn't document a single, like, 4 or 5 Pinocchio lie that Jimmy Carter told when he was president. He certainly exaggerated sometimes, and I don't think he was, you know, humble. A lot of people talk about how humble he is. I think a humble politician is a contradiction in terms, and he certainly made his share of mistakes, but he is unquestionably a man of great decency, accountability, and integrity. And I think his story can help light our way to a better place in our politics. And also, you know, to the question of why now, the man has never had a biography before. I mean, Ted Kennedy is a great rival, and you know, they were like oil and water. The story between them is a fascinating one. I believe he's had 9 biographies. So I found a real hole in the line of scrimmage here about Carter and his quite novelistic, cinematic life, from barefoot boy with no electricity and running water to global icon.
So talk about Carter and Kennedy in this context, if you would. Carter was not always the darling of more progressive Democrats. Kennedy ran that primary challenge against Carter in 1980. For people who don't know this history, he was a sitting president, Jimmy Carter, at that time, and it's rare for a sitting president to get a serious challenge from his own party in the primaries as an incumbent. And the conservative magazine National Review, reviewing another book about Carter in 2018, described him as a fiscally conservative former naval officer who was pro-life, taught Sunday school, and distrusted unions. So how much of that do you agree about?
Well, he was fiscally conservative, but not as we would define it now. I mean, he did reduce the deficit, and there were some budget cuts that liberal Democrats found painful. But he also, you know, expanded things like food stamps, and he believed in an activist government. He did a lot with the unions. He just didn't give them all of their agenda, and arguably he didn't fight hard enough for a labor law reform bill in the 1970s that would have strengthened unions. So it was not a question of whether Carter was progressive, but whether he was liberal enough for Democrats at that point. And I think there's a lesson there in Carter's career for today, for the way we approach Joe Biden. So when Carter would get half a loaf and sign a bill that maybe wasn't as great as liberals wanted, he was condemned for it. And instead, he should have been applauded. He was getting a tremendous amount of important legislation through Congress, 14 major pieces of environmental legislation. For instance, the first leader anywhere in the world at the end of his time in office who understood that climate change was a threat. And he was a president of science. So it would be too simple to say that he was a conservative. You know, he was personally pro-life because of his, you know, his own religious convictions. But as a matter of public policy, he was pro-choice. And he consistently stood up for the separation of church and state, which he believed was actually at the foundation of the founding of the Baptist Church by Roger Williams and others. And so he, you know, he was actually, I think, much more progressive president in the eyes of history. And speaking of which, you know, journalists judge presidents by how they do politically. And Carter was a political failure. He was swamped by Ronald Reagan in 1980, and he was ham-handed often in his relations inside the Democratic Party, particularly with Ted Kennedy. But he was a substantive and far-sighted success. And not just because he put solar panels on the roof of the White House, which Reagan took down. That was just symbolic. He was the first president to do any investment in green energy, the first president with fuel economy standards, toxic waste cleanup, doubled the size of the national park system, the greatest environmental and conservationist president since Theodore Roosevelt. That's pretty liberal. And in terms of ethics, Trump would never have been impeached if it wasn't for Jimmy Carter and the Ethics in Government Act of 1978 that protected whistleblowers for the first time. And then they set up these offices of inspector general, and Trump wouldn't have been impeached without that. FISA courts, establishing FEMA. Carter would have done a spectacular job in confronting this virus. This is very clear from any review of his time in office. But, you know, there was a journey here that I'm trying to get at, because, as you know, as you indicated, people have written some about the Carter presidency, about the post-presidency, about his miraculous 1976 campaign where he came out of nowhere. But it's the larger story, which is an American epic, that I think has been neglected until now.
Here's Jeffrey in Harlem. Jeffrey, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I'm an attorney, and I just wanted to give a bit of perspective on Rule 11, which doesn't come up very often because it's very unusual for federal lawyers to act so completely outside the bounds of reason.
Good. Now, let me just jump in and recall for listeners who have joined us since that came up earlier in the program, Jonathan tweeted today that, let me pull it back up here, that these 18 state attorneys general who are going to the Supreme Court to try to overturn the election for Trump should be sanctioned under and possibly disbarred under what's known as Rule 11. And Jonathan says, oh, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a journalist, historian. I only know what I read about Rule 11. So, Jeffrey, you're a lawyer. Fill us in on Rule 11.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, so in normal practice, a judge will state that they're willing to entertain a motion for sanctions, and that's usually not under Rule 11, which is kind of a third rail, and that's for cases where a lawyer is doing something that's just completely and utterly frivolous outside of normal practice and reason. And I've only seen a judge threaten Rule 11 sanctions once. And it was for something that I thought was relatively minor, where someone had reused generic sort of state materials in a federal complaint. But if that can trigger Rule 11 sanctions, it really boggles the mind that no judges here in these federal cases have offered to entertain these motions when these cases are just so astonishingly unmoored from reality. So I don't know why judges aren't doing that here, but I can say that from my view, it is not because of a legal problem.
Do you think judges are reluctant to seem to be sanctioning people politically and they want to pull back from all this trying to punish the other side or one side or another?
I think that is very likely.
Jeffrey, thank you very much. Informative. Jonathan, you want to say something about
that? Yeah, I was just going to say that, judges provide one potential form of sanction, but the bar associations can be petitioned and appealed to. And, you know, I had a caller on a radio show that I do on Sirius XM the other day who talked about a friend who was disbarred for a substance abuse problem. So if somebody can be disbarred for a substance abuse problem that another lawyer complained about, surely they can be disbarred for subverting our Constitution and trying to overturn an election.
Before you go, I mentioned in the intro the passage in your book where Jimmy Carter and Joe Biden clash on busing for integrating public schools. Can you tell some of that story?
Yeah. So Joe Biden, when he was a young senator, was very opposed to mandatory school busing in Delaware. Remember, Kamala Harris's busing experience that she took Biden on in that first debate, that was voluntary busing. And Biden never had a problem with that. But he had a big problem with mandatory school busing, as many politicians did. It was very unpopular with voters. And when Carter became president, and Biden had been his first supporter in the U.S. Senate, Biden went to Carter and asked for his support for a bill that would prevent judges from imposing mandatory school busing. And Carter, who himself had been against mandatory school busing as governor of Georgia, studied the issue, as Carter always did, and told Biden, "Sorry, Joe, this is unconstitutional. I'm not going to back your bill." And Biden was kind of sore about it. There are many other stories that relate to today. One of them is in Peter Baker's piece in the New York Times today about Hunter Biden. And he quotes me talking about the Billy Carter comparison. And Jimmy Carter was burdened by his brother throughout much of his presidency. And there's some lessons there for what could happen with Joe and Hunter Biden. And another thing that happened, we haven't talked at all, Brian, about Carter's inspiring post-presidential career. And one thing that he did in 1990 that I think is very relevant and which met with great approval from President George H.W. Bush at the time, although they later fell out, was that Carter was monitoring an election in Nicaragua. And as you know, he's done that all over the world in over 100 countries. And Daniel Ortega, the Marxist leader of Nicaragua, lost the election to a woman, Violeta Chamorro, and didn't want to leave office. And Carter stayed up all night with Ortega and said, "Look, it's hard to lose. I know I lost when I ran for re-election. Maybe you can make a comeback," which indeed Ortega did later on. "But for the good of the Nicaraguan people, you need to go." And amazingly, Ortega became the first communist leader ever to voluntarily relinquish office and have a peaceful transfer of power.
That's a great story. And
so, you know, if Daniel Ortega can respect the will of the people, why can't Donald Trump and 106 members of the House of Representatives and 17 state attorney generals? It's really a shock to the conscience and really dispiriting, and we cannot let it drop.
Who will be the Jimmy Carter to Donald Trump that Carter was to Daniel Ortega? Is there a Republican in the House willing to do that? We leave it there with Jonathan Alter. His new book is called His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. Jonathan, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.